time and energy right now is probably better devoted to pushing back against the recall.
The ACLU suffers a setback in trying to prevent a Homer City Council recall. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, former Governor Frank Murkowski continues his push for a rail link between Alaska and Canada.
The problem always is getting it off the ground and getting it underway.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
It's been a week since Governor Bill Walker called the legislature into a special session to fix the state's budget crisis. I'm joined by Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman to talk about what's going on in Juneau. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lori.
So what happened in the Capitol today?
Well, Lori, pretty much nothing. The two chambers each met in what's called a technical session. That's where they formally run down the agenda, but they don't do any real business. Other than that, there were no meetings.
So are there any signs of progress?
No. House Speaker Bryce Edgman put out a statement Tuesday saying that House members could go home for the Memorial Day holiday. He called on the Senate to act on a new revenue measure to use as a basis for negotiations. He also wants the Senate to appoint members to a committee to work out differences between the two chambers over changes to oil and gas taxes and tax credits. Leaders of the two chambers are seeking to set the terms of the negotiations. Edgman wants revenue measures to be a part of a compromise, while Senate President Pete Kelly says his caucus won't support a broad-based tax. It's not clear at this point what will cause either side to budge.
So the sticking points are the same and they remain. Are they getting other work done?
A little. Not today, but yesterday the Senate Finance Committee met to hear testimony on a bill that's intended to reduce overdose deaths from prescription opioids. Most professional groups appear to support the bill, but some doctors and pharmacists would like to see the Senate make changes to the bill the House passed on Monday. For example, the state medical board says one of the bill's main provisions, which limits most opioid prescriptions to a 7-day supply, is too vague.
Andrew, are you getting any sense of how much the special session is costing the state?
Special sessions typically cost $20,000 to $30,000 each day. That's according to the Legislative Affairs Agency. It could reach close to $1 million if we go the full 30 days for the special session, and then more than that if there is an agreement at the end of this special session and there's another special session that takes us up to June 30th, which is really the big deadline for avoiding a government shutdown. Much of the cost is to cover the living expenses for lawmakers and for the housing costs for them and their staffs who have to stay in Juneau. I'll be drilling down into those numbers more over the next couple of days. Edgman says House members won't collect per diems, that's those daily costs, while they're home in their home districts. So that would lower the cost if they follow through on that. But Alaskans who'd like to see the legislature fix the state's budget problem are unlikely to see much action until at least next week.
All right, Andrew, we look forward to learning more about those numbers. Thanks for this update.
Thanks a lot, Lori.
That was state government reporter Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau. The Office of Special Prosecutions now has the case in which a state senator is accused of slapping an Alaska Dispatch News reporter in the state capitol. This follows the Juneau Police Department wrapping up its investigation into what Lieutenant David Campbell characterized as a case of harassment. Andrew Peterson heads up the Office of Special Prosecutions and confirmed on Tuesday it had received the case but wouldn't elaborate. Peterson says he cannot comment on ongoing cases. It's up to his office to decide whether to prosecute. Typical criminal cases go to local district attorneys for consideration and prosecution. Alaska Dispatch News reporter Nathaniel Herz says Senator David Wilson slapped him in the Capitol on May 2nd when he asked for the senator's reaction to a story. Herz has an audio recording of the incident. Wilson has declined to comment on the allegation. Under state law, state legislators are immune to misdemeanor arrest while the legislature is in session. An Anchorage Superior Court judge ruled Tuesday against three Homer City Council members seeking to halt a recall election next month. Council members Donna Adderhold, David Lewis, and Catriona Reynolds are subjects of a recall election sparked over two resolutions they crafted and sponsored. The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska represented the council members and is still weighing the possibility of an appeal. KBBI's Aaron Bolton has more.
Superior Court Judge Aaron Marston's ruling found that recall petitioners seeking to oust the three council members correctly followed the process. Elected officials in Alaska are able to be recalled for misconduct in office, incompetence, or failure to perform their duties. Attorney Tom Amodio has defended targets of recall efforts, including former state senator Scott Ogan. Amodio explained that courts, much like Marston's ruling, typically don't dive into the facts of the stated grounds for a recall.
They allege that I did something that I didn't do. And the court says, no, we don't really look at the facts. We don't dig into it. That's not our job. That's the voters' job. They have to determine who to believe. Both sides are given a chance in the recall, in the electoral process, to give a statement.
The ACLU sued the city over City Clerk Joe Johnson's certification of the three petitions, arguing it infringed on the council members' right to freedom of speech. Petitioners claim that by crafting and sponsoring separate resolutions on the Dakota Access Pipeline and inclusivity, council members engaged in political activity and violated their oath of office. They also say irreparable economic harm was inflicted on the city after a draft of the inclusivity resolution was shared on social media. Judge Marston says Johnson was correct to certify the petitions and let voters weigh the merits of the claims. He says Johnson's only role was to decide if the allegations would be grounds for recall if found true. All three council members had one word for Marston's ruling: disappointing.
He has now opened it up so that, you know, anyone can basically do a recall for any reason.
Councilmember Lewis's term is up in October, and he says he's not running for election if he survives the recall.
I had never planned. After 9 years, it's more than enough.
Councilmember Reynolds' term is also up in October, and she says the recall effort has been exhausting. She says it has convinced her to take a year off before running for office again. Adderhold's term is up next year, and she says it's too early to know if this will affect her decision to run. But she says the recall process should be cause for concern.
It gives me concern about the integrity of our election process when a recall can be brought forth when elected officials are doing their jobs.
The ACLU is still deciding whether to appeal the case. Lewis and Adderhold are weighing that option. Reynolds says she will not take part in an appeal.
Time and energy right now is probably better devoted to pushing back against the recall itself and devoting the next little bit of time to working towards that election.
Pro-recall group and Political Action Committee, Heartbeat of Homer, intervened in the case. Spokeswoman Sarah Vance says the group will stay active leading up to the special election. The recall election is scheduled for June 13th. If all three members are recalled, the council would be one member shy of a quorum. The council would have to appoint someone to one vacant seat within 7 days of the election's certification. Community members would be able to apply for remaining spots on the panel. Those seats would need to be filled by July 19th. For KBBI News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The Alaska Supreme Court has decided a woman who had been sexually abused by her foster brother in 2012 will be able to sue the State Office of Children's Services. The Supreme Court published its opinion on the matter on Friday. The woman had been turned away by a Superior Court judge in the past while attempting to pursue a civil case against the state's foster care system. The judge decided her lawsuit had not been filed in time under a law that sets a 2-year maximum time limit for civil liability cases. But the 5 judges of the state Supreme Court disagreed. The case will go back to the same Superior Court judge who first heard the case. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a look at the man behind Alaska's stranger animal news releases.
Alaska's fledgling wood bison herd lost an important member Friday when bison number 124 was illegally shot and killed near the village of Quinnahawk.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're a K-12 teacher, consider the University of Alaska Southeast Juneau campus for Summer in the Rainforest continuing education courses. 2 sessions offered, Basic and Beyond Arts Institute, July 24th through 29th, and Indigenous Arts Institute, July 30th through August 4th. Stipends, scholarships, and on-campus housing are available. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu/summerrain. This message is sponsored by UAS.
A human leg and boot were pulled out of Gastineau Channel near Sandy Beach on Monday afternoon, according to a Juneau Police Department news release. Police spokesman Lieutenant David Campbell says Alaska Department of Fish and Game were conducting debris removal in the channel when they discovered the leg. A Juneau police officer responded to the area and took possession of it. The leg was sent to the state medical examiner's office for potential identification. The condition of the leg made it difficult to determine how long it might have been in the water. Alaska will be at the center of the response if the U.S. gets into a conflict with North Korea. That's according to Alaska senior military officer, Lieutenant General Kenneth Wilsbach. Wilsbach, the head of the Alaskan Command, addressed the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce Tuesday. In response to a question about the North Korean threat, Wilsbach highlighted Alaska's strategic location.
If you saw something, untoward happen on the Korean Peninsula, this is going to be a busy place, not only to get people out of Korea, U.S. citizens out of Korea during a contingency, but then U.S. forces will be flowing through here to go west.
Wilsbach also addressed North Korea's nuclear missile attack capability. He expressed concern about North Korea's accelerated schedule of test launches while assuring all test fires are tracked and assessed.
Their capability of being able to reach the continental United States, we're not really sure that they have that. We're not really sure that they have the capability to reach into more than the Aleutians, really. But we'll see.
Wilsbach emphasized that diplomacy is the United States' first course of action with North Korea, but that Alaska-based forces are poised to respond if needed, including with the missile defense system at Fort Greely. Wilsbach noted that the military is investing $500 million in Alaska this year, more than any other state. Frank Murkowski is again pitching a rail link between Canada and Alaska. It's an old idea the former senator and governor worked on when he was in office. Now Murkowski is back as a special envoy working under the current governor to get talks on the rail link back on track.
You know, there's a lot of potential in Alaska. The problem always is getting it off the ground and getting it underway.
Murkowski spoke at a lunch today put on by the World Trade Center Anchorage. He says the rail link would be funded by the export of Canada's vast deposits of bitumen, a black viscous mixture of hydrocarbons from Alberta to Tidewater.
The bitumen, this huge deposit, has been identified in volumes that are a little hard to comprehend. They're so significant.
The Alberta Sands Project, where the bitumen will come from, is controversial and opposed by many environmental groups because of the ecological damage mining it creates and for how much energy it takes to produce it. There are different proposed routes for the rail construction from Alberta to Alaska, and also at least two options for where to take the bitumen from there. One is to offload it in interior Alaska, treat it, and ship it through the Trans-Alaska pipeline to Valdez and ultimately Asian markets. The other is to send it by rail to Port McKenzie in the Matanuska-Susitna borough, which desperately needs a project of that scale to complete a rail link to the port and generate revenue. Bitumen exported from Port McKenzie would also likely go to Asian markets. Murkowski says there has been no decision made yet on whether Delta or Port Mac is the better option.
Well, it could be both, very frankly. The decision as to what route is going to be conceived, if indeed it's going to be developed, is going to be dependent on the economics of it. In other words, where can you get the highest return on your product?
As for the overall rail link project, Murkowski says there are many more details to iron out before the old idea can become reality. New research could help wildlife managers better protect declining stellar sea lion populations. The study looks at why sea lions zero in on specific hunting hotspots. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
Knowing where to find food is easy for humans, but for stellar sea lions, biologist Mike Sigler says it's a different story.
I wondered for sea lions what they did when they had to find food. They're not fortunate like humans that they can know where the nearest restaurant or corner grocery store is.
This has been a hot topic for researchers who have watched Western stellar sea lion populations decline, hitting a low in 2002. The decline is linked to a lack of food. So Sigler, who works at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, set out to track sea lions' seasonal pattern of foraging in sheltered southeast Alaska. He believes it's probably the only place in the state where this study could have happened because of the harsh conditions in places like the Aleutians. But the conclusions can be applied to other populations. Sea lions are looking for reliable sources of food. Sigler says that's even more important than finding a place that has the most food.
For sea lions, I think what good translates to them as something that's reliable, in other words, it's persistent. Persistence mattered more than how abundant the prey were.
It may seem obvious, but the more consistent prey is in a given location, the more sea lions can thrive there. Understanding that dynamic gives scientists and managers a better idea of the impact temporary fishing closures might have on sea lion populations. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska. At Alaska Pacific University, students are surrounded by beauty, distinguished faculty, and independent-minded creative students pursuing higher education. AlaskaPacific.edu, moving life forward with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Two Ketchikan women are trying to make a difficult topic easier for people to talk about. Their goal is to encourage more people to plan for their own end. KRBD's Layla Carey attended a recent death cafe and has the story.
About 20 people showed up at the Point Art Cafe for a Sunday afternoon of cookies, cake, coffee, and death. Most people don't like talking about death. It's scary. It's uncomfortable. But death is also inevitable. Leisha Kelly King and Marzette Ellis are hospice volunteers, and they're dedicated to helping people prepare for death.
Got to talk about sex, you got to talk about death, right? In life, taxes, I'm here to tell you, you can avoid those.
Kelly King got the discussion started. People sat at tables in groups of 3 to 5. On the tables were grave talk cards with topics to spark the conversation. They had questions like, have you ever seen a dead body? The first group I joined, Greg and Patty Howe and Felix Wong, were already talking.
So what's the topic you guys are on now?
The topic that we're on is funerals and the impressions. Have you been to a funeral? And if so, what impression did it make? Well, what was it that you said to Felix, that the more ceremony,
the less meaning it had. The more informal, outdoors, the more connected I felt to the person who had passed.
But they could all see how some people might need a more formalized traditional ceremony. Wong says it can help them deal with the strong emotions surrounding the loss of a loved one. Greg and Patty already have been talking about death. Greg has leukemia and says the outcome is not really clear right now. Patty says nothing will really prepare her for Greg leaving her.
But talking about it, it's not something that we're like ignoring or saying it's not going to happen. We're just embracing every day as it comes and not letting it define us. And also at 65, realizing just how short life is.
Damio Suarez learned that lesson at an early age. He told a separate group a story about when he was 15, living in Miami, Florida, and his 20-something brother-in-law was killed. Suarez says he didn't believe it at first.
I was just a complete denial, like, no way, this you can't just die. Like, there's no way. Just completely blew it off. Complete denial. I didn't believe it until I actually got to the funeral. I saw his body in the casket, and I was like, oh God, wait, he's actually dead.
Suarez says that experience made him realize anyone could die at any time, and it made him more aware of how he treats everyone he meets.
I try to be like really like caring and there for them, you know, because like I don't want someone to just like, I don't want someone to be home and think, man, no one really cares, or no one cares if I do this, or it doesn't matter if I do that, because no one's going to remember me. Like, I would hope that they would think, oh yeah, this guy, like, he's always there, he always wants to talk to me.
So not typical small talk conversation among people who've just met, right? Death Cafe is new for Ketchikan, but it's not a new concept. There's even a website with information about how to get a Death Cafe started. Marzette Ellis says she and Kelly King already have been holding monthly open house opportunities to help anyone who shows up make an advanced health care directive.
Not enough people were showing up. I mean, we were getting 3 or 4, which was fabulous, and we're thankful. We're thankful for one person, and it's a profound experience. And we invite anybody and everybody, but we needed some way to reach more people, to get more people talking.
And while researching that topic, they found the Death Cafe. Kelly King says the goal is to make death less negative, and the two women are quite positive about the topic, to the point where their family members have asked them to be more serious.
It's like you guys are laughing too much about death, and death isn't funny.
Yeah.
Well, death is funny.
Yeah.
You know, death is funny. Death is not a scary, you know, you don't have to be crying and weeping over death.
Kelly King says the crying and weeping is in part because of uncertainty, and that can be relieved somewhat by a formal plan. But at the Death Cafe, people who show up know what they're going to be talking about. So what about the other 12,980 people, approximately, in the Ketchikan Gateway Borough? How to reach them? Well, Ella says they've invited lots of people.
9 times out of 10, the conversation goes nowhere.
Yes.
Period. Nowhere. And
yeah, I think that's true.
And that's what they say. You have these early, you know, you start with the people who want to come.
And it's hoped those people will continue the difficult conversations outside of the Death Cafe, helping society at large make the end of life a little less uncertain and a little less scary. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey. State wildlife managers have the unusual job of alerting the public whenever there's weird animal news. That can mean opening a hunt for a muskox stranded on an iceberg, telling dog owners to keep pets away from nesting cranes, or reminding Anchorageites not to leave caribou carcasses in their backyard because it invites bears. Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes talked to one of the bards of the South Central Mooselandia Wordsmiths of Wildlife Management, who says the job is as literary as it is zoological.
Wildlife, Ken.
Ken Marsh is sitting in his office.
Hey, listen, I'm with a reporter right now, Tony. Can I give you a call back in just a few?
The small, dim room could easily belong to any accountant or insurance salesman, except for the stuffed ram's head hanging above the desk. It's a doll sheep with thick, curling horns that Marsh shot in the 80s. And until recently, it just decorated his homes. until he started working for the Department of Fish and Game.
I needed to do something with it, and I thought, what more appropriate place than right here over my office where I can look at it during the day and kind of get some, evoke some memories. And also, I guess it's sort of a marker, you know, this guy's a hunter, which I am.
Marsh grew up in Alaska during the late 60s and 70s, an avid outdoorsman. He even spent time as a trapper in the Susitna Valley.
Yeah, we trapped off of snowshoes for marten, mink, beaver, that sort of thing there in the valley.
It was a hard way to make a living, and Marsh eventually decided that he needed a job. From the time he was in high school, his passion was split between biology and writing.
When I got into college, I realized biologists had to do a lot of math, and journalists didn't. So journalism ended up winning.
Marsh spent the next few decades working in newspapers and magazines, from the Valdez Vanguard to writing a fishing column at the Anchorage Daily News. But his enthusiasm for the outdoors never dimmed. In 2008, he started working for ADF&G's sport fish division before moving over to his current role on the game side of the department as a public information officer, which means it's Marsh's job to write press releases that can make an impact.
Alaska's fledgling wood bison herd lost an important member Friday when bison number 124 was illegally shot and killed near the village of Quinnahawk.
Like this one, an especially somber and poetical piece from January.
A wanderer that captured the hearts of rural communities across western Alaska, bison 124 was a young cow known for its extensive exploration of the Yukon, Kuskokwim, and Innoko drainages.
This is not your run-of-the-mill press release, especially from a branch of state government. Marsh writes about all the communities that reported sightings of this particular wood bison, and there's a sentimental note of loss permeating the prose.
The bison was salvaged and donated to a Bethel charity.
In the email sent out to reporters, a photo was attached, featuring a lone bison standing before a vast expanse of tundra and small, nameless ponds.
Bison 124 had a knack for identifying suitable habitat where future generations of bison could prosper. Valuable knowledge the animal gained can no longer be shared with the main herd and is now lost.
Ultimately, the tale of wood bison 124 made it into statewide newspapers and the evening news.
But to those closely following the project, she was so much more than a number.
Marsh is fully aware that good writing with a bit of flair is instrumental to getting information for management biologists out to the public. Information that can start off wonky and dense.
When I work with our biologists, they're scientists, and there is a certain amount of scientific jargon, if you will, that is a part of their everyday speech. It's how they work. It's basically their language.
Marsh sees his work as translating, with maybe just a dash of literary media manipulation, too, all to help coax the public into better grasping the complicated interactions between wildlife and the humans who live nearby.
So that people can actually enjoy the resource, so that the wildlife doesn't crash, and that's what wildlife management's really all about.
Through his words, he's helping keep the outdoors wild. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Jeremy Shea, and Trip Krause in Juneau, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, and Casey Grove and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.